Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, December 3rd, 2020. Producing from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut is Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. And Taylor, the second of our off-season podcasts, we talked about this being a good day to do one because we had a flurry of action yesterday.
Great day to do it. I was putting the rundown together last night, and I'm a little bit removed from the baseball world, working on college football, college basketball, all that, and I'm going through all the headlines from the last 2 weeks, and it took me a while to assemble everything, so great timing for sure.
Yeah, 55 players tossed out into free agency through non-tenders, actually 56, but then Kyle Farmer quickly re-signed with the Cincinnati Reds. But a massive players on the move last night, and we'll get into all that. And just real quick before we go forward, I think that through the rest of December, let's just sort of play it by ear in terms of how much action we have. Like if there's, you know, major signings in the next week, if the Mets money begins to manifest and they sign a George Springer, they sign a Trevor Bauer, I think we'll have to get the band back together. What do you think?
Oh, yeah. Emergency pod. Let's do it.
All right. I mentioned all the players who were not tendered yesterday. Among those, Kyle Schwarber of the Chicago Cubs, Adam Duvall, who had a nice year for the Atlanta Braves last year. Corey Knable, there had been a lot of speculation that he might be non-tendered by the Milwaukee Brewers. In the end, the Brewers kept him, but then traded him to the Los Angeles Dodgers for cash considerations. The New York Mets reached a 2-year deal with one of the best relievers available, Trevor May, for $15.5 million, that according to Jeff Passan. The Angels, who are looking to win in 2021, Perry Minasian, their new general manager, making a deal for a shortstop. Jose Iglesias getting him from the Baltimore Orioles. And one last note, and I think I'm going to ask Paul Ambichides about this. Last week we heard that Robinson Cano has been suspended for the entire 2021 season for PED use, stanozol. He actually tested positive for. And I'll tell you a theory among baseball executives how Robinson Cano wound up with stanozol in his system. Now, before we get to Jesse Rogers and Dan Shulman, my old friend and Ford Frick nominee, and Paul Ambichides, I want to talk about how it's V-Week. And during these challenging times, ESPN and the V Foundation's fight against cancer has not stopped. If you're able, please support cancer research by using v.org/donate. 100% of what you give goes to cancer research. It's a cause that's near and dear to us at ESPN. Any contributions are greatly appreciated. Jesse Rogers covers baseball for ESPN, and Jesse, last night, as we anticipated, a bunch of players getting dropped out into the free agent market through team non-tenders, 55 more guys, which means that the list of free agents now is well over 200. I thought there were two groups that got killed in particular in terms of the volume being now added to that to their particular positions, a ton of relievers, and a ton of corner outfielder types. What was your reaction generally for yesterday?
Well, actually, I was pleasantly surprised, if you're a fan of players and their agents, that more weren't dumped into the marketplace. I think agents were expecting an extraordinary bloodbath yesterday. I don't think it came, to be honest. I think there were 42 arbitration-eligible players last year that were non-tendered. So this season wasn't that far off of that this offseason. So I think players should be a little bit excited today that there's a little bit less in the marketplace than a lot of people thought. We saw a lot of pre-tender deals and a couple trades in there. I'm actually encouraged by what went on because I think now, if we want to move it forward, Buster, is going to be a big-time slowdown. Even though there's a lot out there, yes, some players will be picked off, but I think there's a lot of factors that are going to slow some teams down, starting with, of course, attendance in 21 being uncertain and moving all the way down to the rules and what's going to stay in place and what's going to change. But I don't think it was as bad a bloodbath as we thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Moving forward, it's interesting. I've had agents say this to me and I've had general managers say it to me, and it's weird to hear in the context of a baseball conversation, but you keep on hearing it's all going to come down to the vaccine. Like, how quickly will the vaccine information manifest? And when there's a coronavirus vaccine that's widely available to fans to begin to build the confidence for people to go back and fill ballparks?
You know, executives said last night, and it was so true, that yesterday If you think about this, it's so true. Yesterday is the last deadline for anything to happen until, I guess, arbitration hearings. So teams can really slow down their offseason until they get more information, first and foremost, about that vaccine for their own players and certainly for the fans. Are only people over 60 going to be allowed in April because those are the people that are going to be vaccinated? I mean, there's all these question marks, and that's why this slowdown will happen, because there's no reason to move forward. Yesterday, you had to do some moving around because there was a tender deadline. There are no deadlines. It's not like, December 15th now, free agents have to be signed, and then January 1st, it's nothing until arbitration hearings, Buster. So, yes, vaccine information is going to be widely sought after, and it's going to slow everything down, in my opinion.
All right. Now, the team that you cover on a regular basis, the Chicago Cubs, were right at the center of the conversation yesterday about the non-tenders. And it does feel like this was the official blow-up of the core position players that won that championship in 2016. Tell me what you saw yesterday and where you see the Cubs now spinning forward with these individual players.
Yeah, if I could, look down from 35,000 feet. Think about this, Buster. I know not everybody listening follows the Cubs as closely as we do. Theo Epstein's first-round pick in 2012 and 2014, both non-tendered on the same day. Their first-round pick in 2013, Chris Bryant, more than likely is going to be moving on from this team within the next 12 months, if not sooner. So now the Cubs can build around two guys, Buster, that are actually Jim Henry guys, the GM before Theo Epstein. Javi Baez and Wilson Contreras were Hendry additions. They outlasted Epstein, who's moved on here. So it is a complete changing of the guard in a lot of ways. Though, ironically, they're building around those two for now. At least Contreras is sought after in the market, and he could be on the move. His backup, Victor Caratini, is Darvish's guy behind the plate and pretty darn good himself. But in any case, yes, Wednesday was the start of a turnover of this roster. Those first-round picks from 12, 13, and 14, more than likely gone. Two of them already are gone, and Bryant's probably going to be gone because he's a free agent in a season. So this is a long-term project for them, Buster. I don't think they're thinking about the World Series in 2021 at all, not for a second. Sure, you'd love to be a contender, but more important would be a retool like the Yankees did and make that trade, ironically, like the Yankees did to the Cubs, Gleyber Torres, to them for Aroldis Chapman. If the Cubs could make a deal like that, get back a young guy to help them contend over the next 5 or 6 years, starting in like 22, that would be the goal for this team.
All right, real quick, give me 30 seconds on this. Teams that you think might be a fit for Chris Bryant.
The LA Dodgers come to mind. Moving on from Justin Turner, stick him there. Not a lot of pressure, 1 year. Maybe they want to sign him up for longer term, but after the Betts deal, probably not. The Dodgers come to mind big time. When you win a World Series, Buster, sometimes it's good to change the dynamic a little bit. It's hard to repeat, especially with that team who's had very similar players for a bunch of years trying to attain that goal. Now they've gotten there. I think Bryant would be a perfect fit in L.A. to replace Justin Turner.
Yeah, I wonder about the Nationals and the Atlanta Braves. You know, the Atlanta Braves love their one-year deals. And Chris Bryant would be there.
That would have been my pick last year. Yeah, that would have been my pick last year, the Braves. And if Ozuna moves on, absolutely, he still fits there for sure.
Yeah, I think Ozuna is definitely going to move on, or more particularly, I think the Braves are not going to be willing to pay him anymore. They were Josh Donaldson. And Kyle Schwarber, to me, as I was thinking about it today, he basically, obviously, his strategy for him would be to take a one-year deal someplace. I'm looking at the Baltimore Orioles and saying that is a great place for him to go and play. Nice ballpark. It would fit him. He probably would get some at-bats at DH, put up some big numbers, become a free agent next fall.
How about the other side of Chicago? They just let Nomar Mazara go. They have very little left-handed hitting. They're on the verge of something special. The White Sox I'm talking about. I think he'd fit perfect. He'd do exactly, and if not more, than what Mazara was expected to do. Mazara was a 20-home run guy. Obviously prorated, he wasn't going to hit 20, but he hit one last year. He was non-tendered. I think he'd be perfect on the south side. The only problem is they have several DH types there. Jose Abreu, Eloy Jimenez, not a very good outfielder. And now you'd add Kyle Schwarber. But, I could foresee a one-year deal. I could also foresee a multi-year deal somewhere. I think he understands the marketplace and he wouldn't mind a little security. So I don't think he has to sign for 1 year. And also, he's a very volatile player. So there's no guarantee that 1 year is going to produce a multi-year contract. You know, he may want to get a little security here because he is a guy that has had a lot of peaks and valleys.
Yankees as well. You know, they're a team that could definitely use some left-handed hitting. Kyle Schwarber in Yankee Stadium has been a fantasy for a lot of people for a lot of years. But they do have a lot of outfielders. And, you know, so we'll see if they wind up being a fit. Yeah, I think there's no doubt as we go forward, Jesse, that two great questions that will never be fully answered about the Cubs after 2016. Why did they struggle so badly to develop pitching? And two, why didn't the core group of young Chicago Cubs position players get better? And you know, they'll go down in history, I think, this group of players, kind of like those mid-'80 Mets teams that were so talented but won one championship and didn't win more. All right, let's talk about Gary Sanchez. The Yankees make the decision to keep him. I think they're still intrigued by the possibility that he could find himself offensively because, yes, everyone knows he's not very good defensively. He's probably not going to get better defensively. But they've thought for years after his early showing in his career that this is someone who get 270, 280. And I think that's, in the end, is what brought them back, thinking that, you know what? The free agent market has a couple of high-end guys, JT Realmuto, James McCann, who's getting a lot of attention. You know, I think there's a chance McCann winds up with a team like the Mets. I don't think the Yankees are going to want to pay Realmuto. And so, in the end, the fact that there are not that many guys who can be number one type catchers in the free agent market, I think in the end pushed them back to Sanchez. What do you think?
Yeah, I think by default is kind of what you're saying here because this guy is such a perfect candidate for a change of scenario, change of scenery, I should say. You know, it's not easy to play for the Yankees and play that position and fail and take the abuse. I just felt like from a distance here, that guy seemed like a change of scenery for sure. And there's a couple Cubs in that category. Chris Bryant may even be one of them, sort of similar. You know, you go through some ups and downs and you burst onto the scene, Buster, and then things level off and then you get injured a little bit and there's all sorts of things and sometimes that moves. So I am a little surprised by that to sort of go back to that and try to finagle something that, yeah, was good for a moment in time there offensively, but it just hasn't worked out since then. I was surprised, to be honest. I thought he'd move on.
What'd you think of the Dodgers deal late last night for Corey Knebel?
Also surprised. I've seen Knebel a lot. I've seen him at his best. I've seen him at his worst. And he certainly has something to prove, I think. I'm not saying he's done by any means, but I was a little surprised by that. You know, in that scenario, what are the Dodgers thinking? They must be thinking there's some other teams interested, right? Because today he would have been available to everybody and the Dodgers could just pick him off. So they must have heard something about other interest in him. And or from a scouting standpoint, see something that a lot of other people don't see because, you know, he was dominant for a moment in time there, but I think that's past. Not saying he can't get back there, but I was a little surprised by the trade.
In 2017, he had 126 strikeouts in 76 innings. He missed all of 2019 with Tommy John surgery. So maybe they feel like they're getting him back just as he's regaining his strength. I mentioned the Braves and their one-year strategy. I think the Braves are as well set up as any team moving forward because they've got their two young stars, Ronald Acuna Jr., Ozzie Albies, under these two great team-friendly contracts. They are at some point going to have to pay Freddie Freeman. And then they have this really deep rotation, so their payroll is very well managed. And we've seen Alex Anthopoulos, their general manager, time and time and time again make these one-year deals with veterans. You know, he did it with Josh Donaldson. Last year he did it with Marcell Ozuna. He did it with Cole Hamels, one that didn't necessarily work out. This offseason he's done it with Drew Smyly and Charlie Morton, giving the Braves, I think, probably the deepest rotation of baseball.
This is one of my favorite GMs in all of baseball. I mean, you could hand him that award, GM of the Year, Executive of the Year, every single year, in my opinion, the way he's going about it with that team. Locking up those young guys, team sort of friendly deals, right? I love the fact he's sticking with Snitker, sort of an old school manager. Okay, they haven't won it all, but they've come pretty close. They're not really underachieving. The playoffs are a crapshoot. I love the one-year deals. I mean, I can't believe he's the only one really taking advantage of it, Buster. And you said it right. Cole Hamels didn't work out. That's okay. There are no bad one-year deals. You get guys that are incentivized, right? They want their next contract. You get guys that are playing to win, like Cole Hamels. He just wants to go to a winner. Charlie Morton, great example. If this team isn't set up the way they are, I don't think Charlie Morton comes back to the Braves. I love every single thing Alex Anthopoulos has done, and that includes a couple mistakes here and there because everyone's going to make mistakes. But if they're one-year mistakes, Buster, that's not a big problem or issue at all. Great mix in that locker room, and I'm with you on that pitching staff. If healthy, you know, boy, that's a pretty deep staff, and Morton is a perfect finishing touch. I thought John Lester might land there as kind of a perfect finishing touch, but Charlie Morton is just as good and obviously has thrown in some big, big games.
All right, the big four, I think, in the open market at this point, you've got the free agents, Trevor Bauer, Springer Realmuto, Francisco Lindor, also among the big four, someone who is expected to be traded by the Indians during the course this wintertime. Look, I don't think a lot has necessarily developed. I think at some point the Mets' money is going to manifest. I think the surest thing out of the group of four is that Springer's going to wind up with the Mets. And I if I'm sitting here today and I'm guessing where Trevor Bauer is going to land, I'm going to say it's either going to be the Angels or I think more likely the Toronto Blue Jays, who when you talk to agents and you ask them who's being aggressive right now, they always bring up the Blue Jays and the Mets. What do you hear on that group of four?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about the Mets, obviously, like everyone's saying since Cohn took over. Here's what's interesting is how quickly the Mets will move compared to the rest of the teams. As we spoke earlier, I think there's going to be a huge slowdown. But savvy teams that can spend, might want to jump on some guys because guys don't want to wait till January 15th to sign, right, or February 1st. Now, maybe the Trevor Bauers of the world would. He's a little off, but I don't know if George Springer, as good as he is, wants to wait that long to sign. So if the Mets move quickly, I'm with you. I think they get one, if not a couple. Bauer is the wild card, though, when it comes to the one-year deal, the five-year deal. What does he want exactly? Certainly wants to go to a winner. That's kind of obvious. I thought he'd be a nice fit with the Cubs if they were contending, you know, pair him with Darvish. They're close buddies and could talk baseball day and night, but that's not going to happen even on a one-year deal. So to me, Bauer's a wild card. I can't really gauge that. I mean, the Angels are as good a guess as any because you know they'll pay him, and they certainly need him. But I'm interested in how quickly the Mets move on some of this. And if they move early, will other teams move early as well? So I feel like the Mets can set the market here.
All right, Jesse, thanks for doing this. Look forward to talking with you again.
It's going to be a long offseason, Buster. Talk to you soon.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11 ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Dan Schulman has been named the winner of the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame's 2020 Jack Graney Award, given annually to a member of the media who has made significant contributions to baseball in Canada. And he's also been nominated for the Frick Award for Baseball's Hall of Fame. These are heady times, my friend.
Thank you. It's really been an honor. I didn't know either one was coming. I didn't know what time of year they announced these things. Like, both of them kind of came out of the blue, but I really appreciate it. You know, the Jack Rainey Award is a special one for Canadians. The Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame does a wonderful job. It's in a little picturesque town called St. Mary's, Ontario, kind of a Cooperstownish city. It's a town. It's about 90 miles west of Toronto, and some people that I've really admired, and you knew or know, you know, Dave Van Horn is in the Hall of Fame, and Tom Cheek, Jerry Howarth, and Bob Elliott, and, you know, people like that. So to you know, to be on a list with people I admire that much is really special.
And I thought it was cool that you were nominated in the same year as our old friend Dave Soup Campbell. And as I began to write out the podcast today, I was like, you know what, we got to tell some Soup Campbell stories. And then I was like, no, we can't. We can't tell any stories about Dave Campbell. Yes, would you agree with me?
Soup is a very colorful character, you know, and he was wonderful to me. We worked together, I think it was 7 years on Sunday Night Baseball. And when I got the call from the folks in Cooperstown about being nominated for the Frick, I was like literally stunned. I think you and I texted that day. I had no idea. And then they sent me the press release. And the next thing I noticed was, holy cow, Soup is on the list. And I thought it was the first time that he was on the list. So I picked up the phone and I called him right away. And he didn't know about it at the time. Like I had just seen it. Well, I had just seen it on Twitter and just found out about it. And I'm not spending a lot of time on Twitter. So I called him and he didn't know about it. And we talked for a while and kind of reminisced a little bit and said, you know what, we had a pretty good thing when we did it, you know, and we were together for a long time. And I'm very, very happy for him. He was a terrific broadcaster, as you know, a very cerebral guy and looking at the game, worked hard, a unique character let's say that. But I really enjoyed my time with him.
Yeah, that's awesome. And definitely rooting for you guys as we get closer to that announcement. All right. So this winter, when I talked to agents and asked them, okay, who's actually in this winter when a lot of teams are going to be cutting back their payroll to offset losses that they incurred in 2020, losses that they are anticipating for 2021 because of the pandemic, I get the same two teams back every time. The Mets and the Blue Jays, a team you know well. What's your sense of the Blue Jays this winter?
Well, Buster, that sounds very accurate. And the Blue Jays, maybe not to quite the same extent as the Mets, but they're in an enviable position because for a couple of reasons. One is their core is young, and that means cheap. You look at Bichette and Biggio and Guerrero and Gurriel and Tellez and Teoscar Hernandez, et cetera, et cetera. They're all young, so none of them are making a lot of money. So the Blue Jays do appear to have a significant amount of money to spend, which is great. And I think the other nice thing they've got going for them is they can be interested in just about anybody. It's not like they need this specific guy or the whole winter is lost. Because they've got positional versatility, they've got decisions to make. And Biggio offers them a lot of flexibility. So do they go after a shortstop? Yeah, they can, and then they can move Bichette to second. But they can leave Bichette at short and get a third baseman. They can get an outfielder and maybe free up the DH spot a little bit or trade one of them for some pitching. So I totally understand that they're in on a lot of different guys. Now, whether they get any of them is another story. Historically, Toronto's had to pay a bit of a premium to get premium free agents. But they are in a very good spot this winter, I think, and there's no question they're going to strengthen their team.
Now, they have been linked to George Springer, but I was telling Jesse Rogers before that among all the, you know, the prime free agents, the guy I'm most sure about landing with a particular team is George Springer going to the Mets. But the Blue Jays have been talking with Springer. They've obviously been linked to Trevor Bauer and Ross Atkins, their general manager, their president, Mark Shapiro. They know Trevor from their time together when they were all in Cleveland. And, of course, Francisco Lindor, again, had been with the Indians when those guys were there. Among these guys, I'm not going to ask you to guess which guy's going to land with them, but which guy do you look at as being, that guy is a great fit?
Well, I think a guy you haven't mentioned who's a top-tier guy, DJ LeMahieu, I think is a great fit. Again, because the Blue Jays love positional flexibility. So not to get too deep into the weeds on it, but... You know, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is down 40 pounds from the beginning of the season, 20 from the end of the season. He's about 240. That's the good news. The bad news is that means he was 280 during the season, and he just couldn't play third base. But he's at 240 now with 2.5 months to go. They are hoping, obviously, that this is sustainable, and it helps his bat speed. It helps his hitting. but also that it helps his defense wherever he is. So, you know, are they going to give Guerrero a chance to go back to third base? I don't know. If they let him go back to third base and he can handle that, then they've got Rowdy Tellez at first, assuming they really think he's a building block, and then the DH spot is freed up. And then you can do whatever you want. LeMahieu can play third one day and Guerrero can DH. LeMahieu can play first and Tellez can DH. Biggio can play anywhere. So LeMahieu's a phenomenal fit. Plus, he's a phenomenal hitter. And the Blue Jays, as good as they are offensively, as much as the ceiling is very high, they've got a lot of swing and miss. LeMahieu's a different kind of a hitter and an on-base machine, a guy who, you know, just hits line drives all over the place. And what a fit he would be hitting up at the top of the order around Biggio and Bichette in front of Guerrero and Hernandez. So I think he's a great fit. I think George Springer's a great fit, too. And you could put him in center. And then, again, if the DH spot is open, they can maybe put Teoscar Hernandez there, or they could trade somebody. Maybe you hear Gurriel's name every now and again, trade him for some pitching. So, again, they've got flexibility. But the two guys I think of as being the best fits are Springer and LeMahieu.
What was your reaction when you saw the Vladdy Jr. Video of him working out? Because I was like, wow, and I was really excited. Yeah. Because a lot of you and I have both seen a lot of players who are heavy early in their careers and they struggle to keep up with it, get ahead of it.
Yeah, you don't want to look back 5 years from now and say, you know, Guerrero had a nice career, but he wasn't what he should have been. You know, and we've seen guys struggle with this. Pablo Sandoval has struggled. Miguel Sano has struggled. A number of guys have struggled. And Vladdy apparently came into camp last year in better shape. Not great, but in better shape. But then in the lockdown, it really got away from him. And when they put him at first, Buster, and you know this, it's like that scene from Moneyball where, you know, Ron Washington, they're talking to Scott Hatterberg, and is first base easy? No, it's extremely hard. It's extremely hard. There are a million things to learn at first base, and Guerrero was over there like a fish out of water, just really struggling. And again, maybe they won't let him move back to third, but whatever position he plays, if he's down at 240, 230, 220, something like that, it can only help him. And I wonder if it was nothing more than him looking around in the offseason, like his peers, his guys, are Juan Soto and Fernando Tatis and Ronald Acuna. Guerrero's supposed to be in that group. He's the fourth Beatle of that group, right, in terms of hype and when these guys were coming up. He's not supposed to hit, 270 with an 820 OPS. He's supposed to hit 330 with like a 1,000 OPS. He's supposed to be that guy. And maybe, you know, something, the light bulb has gone on and he says he's matured a little bit. I mean, I don't even think he's 22 yet. Maybe he's matured a little bit and he says, okay, it's time to get to work. And I think it's very exciting for the Blue Jays because, you know, when you think about what is supposed to make the Blue Jays great going forward, Guerrero being great is the number one thing. Nate Pearson is supposed to lead the rotation. Bo Bichette is going to be a star, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. But Guerrero being great is a huge piece of the puzzle. And I hope it's sustainable, and I hope it, you know, leads to a lot of improvement in his play as well.
All right, Dan. Well, I appreciate your time. And again, I'll have my fingers crossed for you when the Frick Award is announced coming up.
I appreciate that, Buster. Good talking to you as always.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk?
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo, of course, is Paul Hembekiti. He's a researcher at ESPN who's a head honcho on the show Get Up. At least that's what he tells us. Greeny tells us that he's just a wild partier that he admires. All right. I like doing variations on that every time. It's kind of fun.
You really nail it, bro. You really nail it.
Oh, thank you. All right. Let's. We talked a little bit with Jesse Rogers about Kyle Schwarber and what his future is. You know, I think everyone, to go the captain obvious route, you'd say Yankees, because potentially it would seem to be a fit in Yankee Stadium. They need left-handed hitting. They do have a lot of outfielder DH types. I kind of wonder if he would necessarily fit in that group. I always think of the Orioles anytime a free agent, you know, hits the market looking for a one-year deal. Nelson Cruz proved that back in the day. That's a great place to go and rehabilitate your numbers. Oakland, he seemed to be their type of player, you know, or maybe they find a spot for him. Jesse mentioned the White Sox. Any team or any place that really jumps out to you?
Well, I think the way that you described it in your tweet this morning is actually quite good, in that it sort of depends what his priorities are, and we can't quite know that. If it is his number one intention to have a chance to win a championship and perhaps sign a short-term deal, then maybe the Yankees would be a good choice. And it is obvious that Yankee Stadium would be a great fit for him or any left-handed hitter who consistently pulls the baseball. But that's actually the most important thing for my money that he needs to identify, is what environment can I hit in that's going to best inflate my value? That's something that we have plenty of data on. We know that Wrigley Field has been among the worst hitters for left-handed power hitters in recent years, especially those who pull the ball. So the Yankee Stadium would obviously make a good deal of sense in that respect. And Baltimore, like you said, another hitter-friendly stadium and a place where he could probably hit in the middle of that lineup and have the chance to rebuild his value. And from their perspective, might have the chance to move him for 150 cents on the dollar at the deadline if he is mashing this year.
Yeah, and I had a follower point out, and I hadn't thought of this, and I was like, oh, that's a good one. And this is not a major factor. I mean, the number one factor is going to be what he wants, as you pointed out. Winning would be another factor. But Brandon Hyde, the Oriole manager, of course, used to be a coach of the Cubs when Schwarbs was there. So, maybe that would be something else that might be attractive to him. All right. So I sent you some questions last night. I'm curious to see what you have on these. First question, after the Braves have done these moves, adding Drew Smyly, adding Charlie Morton, in your mind, how far ahead are the Braves of the rest of the National League East right now?
I, Buster, don't see the Braves as the clear-cut front-runner to win the National League East, as much as that might surprise you. Now, I did really admire their decisiveness in identifying Smyly and Morton as two guys that would obviously supplement a rotation to a large degree, and that will probably be the best pitching rotation in baseball in terms of avoiding home runs, which is obviously a major factor with the way the modern game is played. But I view the Mets as a team that could absolutely challenge the Braves to win the division this year, even if they can field an average pitching staff. It was the Mets last year, Buster, that had the best lineup in baseball, at least as measured by the advanced metrics that we use, OPS Plus in this case, 22% above the league average that lineup was. Most of those guys come back. They also, conversely, had the worst ERA Plus in the National League. They were the worst team in preventing runs in the whole circuit. So for my money, if most of those guys come back theoretically from a lineup perspective, and you can add a few arms to supplement Jacob deGrom in the starting rotation and Edwin Diaz in the bullpen, they seem like a team awfully willing to spend money. It's not obvious to me that the Mets can't be playing meaningful games the last week or two of the season and certainly can make the playoffs, if not challenge the Braves for the division. I think that lineup is one of the most underrated in baseball.
Perry Minasian takes over as general manager of the Angels. Do you see a window of opportunity for the Angels in the American League West?
I don't, and I hate to be bleak, but this is a club that's so poorly rounded, Buster. They ranked 24th last year in base running, 27th in defensive run saved, and 25th in run prevention. So when you couple that with the fact that they're paying $120 million to their top four position players, it seems like a bleak outlook, especially when you consider that's a club that ranks sort of in the bottom third among most prospect rankings that you see out there. So there's not a whole lot of help coming. Joe Adell is obviously a huge piece of that team in the near future, as is Shohei Ohtani. Both of those guys, real question marks. So from where I sit, I see both Oakland and Houston as clearly better than them right now. And frankly, the direction of the program in Seattle is also one that gives me a lot more optimism because of their process. There's a chance that the Angels could catch lightning in a bottle for a year, maybe two, because they can really hit. But I'm not confident they can get anybody out or really do anything else for that matter all that well.
I'm writing a column about the challenge for Perry Minasian working for Artie Moreno, who's known as an owner who gets involved, which is his prerogative, by the way. But I asked around, I'm like, what advice would you have for Perry going into that job? And what I got back was, don't worry about the future. Just focus entirely on 2021. If they added either Jake Odorizzi or Trevor Bauer into their rotation, would that make you look at them differently?
If they added either of those pitchers, yes, I think that the opportunity for them to sniff a wild card would exist. But it's going to require probably an 8 or 10 win season for Mike Trout, which he is very capable of doing. But that's how good they need him to be, because the rest of that roster just isn't all that good, to be frank, Buster. And even if they add one of those two pitchers, the rest of that staff, at best, I think you would project to be something like average. So that's a tough uphill putt for me.
Who should be the National League Central favorite in 2021 as of today?
That is an impossible question to answer, and I ran circles in my head yesterday trying to do it. It's like asking the question right now, which team is not going to lose the NFC East? So in doing this with all four teams that could win it, the team I actually landed on as my favorite at the moment, Buster, is the Brewers, which might surprise you considering.
Whoa, yeah, totally surprises me.
But here's my logic, okay? So obviously a club that there was two games under 500 last year, but a lot of the underlying metrics in a 60-game season, this matters to me more because the sample size is smaller, was a team that ranked third from a pitching staff perspective in expected WOBA. It's a StatCast statistic that measures strikeouts, walks, and quality of contact. And they were only 10% above average from a run prevention standpoint. So that's a roundabout way of saying I think that pitching staff really underperformed. And when you couple Williams and Hader and then in the front end, Burns and Woodruff, that's a really good staff with guys that miss a ton of bats and historic strikeout rate last season for them. I think they can run that back. And this is a lineup Buster who last year got negative 0.4 wins above replacement from Christian Yelich and Kisten Hira combined. There is no chance in heck that will happen again next year. Using the track record for both of those players, it is much more likely, in my judgment, that they'll produce 6, 7, even 8 WAR next year. And if that's the case, I think the Brewers sort of ascend to the top of that division just by the fact that their 2020 performance, I think, was probably the 20th or 25th percentile of what they actually probably should have earned. And if that season would have gone 162 games, they would have wound up winning the NL Central anyway, at least for my money.
So we learned last week that Robinson Cano tested positive for Stanisol, an old-fashioned steroid. He's going to be out all of 2021. The Mets get to save $20 million for an older player in his deal. Let me give you a theory that I've heard from folks in baseball. As you know, during the shutdown, after COVID came in mid-March, there wasn't any steroid testing, PED testing in baseball. And when baseball restarted in July, there also was not any steroid testing. Well, in late August, the testing restarted. And so the thought is, among baseball executives that I've spoken with, is that there might have been players looking at the lack of testing in July and early August thinking, oh, okay, we're not doing testing this year. We can get away with this. Let's juice up, baby. And then possibly that's was the context for decision that Robinson Cano made. We're never going to know for sure unless he comes out and is completely honest. And let's face it, guys who get busted for PEDs are not typically totally honest. What do you think of that theory? And how do you look at Robinson Cano's career now?
Okay, so this is good. So I read your column, and I actually do agree with it in principle because it makes a good bit of sense. The place where I stop, though, Buster, is this is a player who we know is a cheater because he has cheated before, and also a player who, in this case, cheated so brazenly with an unsophisticated steroid. I mean, he wasn't even pretending to cover it up. So maybe he's just out of, give a you-know-what. I don't know, and we also haven't had news that this has been pervasive. There have been no other, positive tests that we know of, or at least not right to this level. So I think there's a really good chance that the theory that you're fielding is correct. But we're also talking about a player with a track record, which I think sort of the optimistic side of me says maybe he's just a bad guy and everyone else still played by the rules. Because, look, at this point, Robinson Cano has sabotaged what should have been a Hall of Fame career. And how could we now look at his performance as a Yankee or in his early years with the Mariners without using this as our backdrop here? This is a player on a Hall of Fame track, 2 positive tests now. He goes in the sort of Manny Ramirez book, and his career didn't even live up to that level. So, I mean, look, as far as I'm concerned, I'm done with Robinson Cano, and the fact that this would happen to him twice is a complete joke. And I don't want to cast aspersions on other players because he is such a cheater, and he's demonstrated that hopefully other people, played by the rules, even though the circumstances were different this year.
All right, Hambo. Well, good to talk with you.
Likewise. Later, boys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher tweets for Thursday. First up, our pal Amy Chapman at Amy R. Chapman writes in.
All right, Amy.
Do you think Tony La Russa actually winds up managing the White Sox? Interesting question. We talked briefly about this on the last pod, but what do you think about the Tony La Russa to the White Sox situation here?
Yeah, because of course he was hired, and the news came out that he had had a second, at least a second DUI. We don't know if he's had more than that in his lifetime. He actually changed his plea the other day. Yeah, I do, Amy, think he's going to wind up managing the White Sox. Just coincidentally, I was having a conversation the other day with a general manager about all the layoffs that we've seen around baseball. And this general manager said on his own, this is when you want to work for Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the White Sox, because he is, without a doubt, one of the most loyal people in baseball. He made up his mind that he wanted to bring back Tony La Russa, and I would be surprised if this news makes him change his mind about bringing back a Hall of Fame manager. I just would. I think other teams would have just, first off, I don't think any other team would have hired Tony, given his age of 76. And B, I think after the DUI news came out, there would have been a lot of teams that would have run for cover and made a change in their decision. But you know what? Tony's hooked up with the one owner, I think, who would stand by him and is going to stand by him. We'll see.
All right, next up, first ballot, Bleacher tweeter P.K. Steinberg, who I guess tallied up all his Bleacher tweets from the last 5 years, and it clocks in at 178, yep. So very impressive stuff. We'll make it 179 today. He writes in, with so many catchers available, do you see any teams grabbing three vets and platooning them all, or would that make pitching staffs kind of malfunction?
Yeah, and some teams, as you know, PK, do carry three catchers. I think it depends on what the roster sizes are going to be to some degree. I would say this, just in talking, and I talked a little bit about this with Jesse, that the perception is that there are not a lot of number one type catchers out in the market, but there are a lot of good complementary catchers. And who knows, maybe some team, you know, gets a trio of guys, you know, and has a young catcher along with two veterans and sort of splits it up 50-50 games, you know, that sort of situation. So we'll see. I like the idea, though, and I do think that that we're seeing teams really wanting to have two catchers who can be semi-regulars as opposed to just relying on one guy, other than the St. Louis Cardinals, of course, have relied on Yadi Molina all these years.
Last one for today, Corey Rukert at CoreyR_12 writes in, the NBA is shelling out nine-figure contracts like the pandemic didn't hurt them at all. Why is Major League Baseball always in penny pincher mode?
Yeah, and agents are asking that question. They feel like that the loss is potentially overstated. I don't know if I can go that far. I mean, you know, these businesses have relied on 162-game schedule with 30,000 people being viewed in the stands. There's some money to be made there.
Just a bit.
So, but I do think that, you know, and I'm hearing this a lot from people working front offices. They hate the fact that the baseball owners, we've seen so many layoffs. And I think that offends a lot of people in the game. They feel like, you know, this is a time where you stand by longstanding employees, and there's been some surprise at how draconian some of these franchises have been about layoffs.
Hate to see it. All right, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Please subscribe to, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. That way, when we drop that big emergency pod over the next couple weeks, you will get it immediately. Thanks, everyone.
My thanks today to Dan, to Jesse, to Hembo, to Taylor. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we must fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.